All right. The clerk may call us to order.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Werke, Judge Ross, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is May 11, 2022. This panel of the court today has six cases on its calendar, three of which will be submitted with oral argument and three of which will be submitted without oral argument, solely on the briefs. The first case set for oral argument is number A22-36, Troy Mack versus Blake Martin, William Martin, and Ian Stinson. Our procedures are largely the same, even though we are on the Zoom format. Appellant has 15 minutes for his initial argument. Respondents collectively have 15 minutes for their responsive arguments, and then appellant has an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. You should be able to see a time clock counting backward on your screen if you have the gallery view or some other appropriate view. I understand from court staff that respondents' counsel have decided to evenly divide the 15 minutes and that counsel for William Martin will go before counsel for Mr. Stinson. Is that correct?
Yes, correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Very good. If there's nothing further from the attorneys, then counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and your client, and you may begin your argument. I would ask both of respondents' counsel to please mute yourself during opposing. I ask all counsel, I guess, to mute themselves during other attorneys' arguments. Counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Dennis Grand. I'm the attorney for the plaintiff. Start my clock. Plaintiff is Troy Mack. He's a guy in his mid-40s. He's clean cut, crew cut. He's a heavy equipment transmission mechanic. And on the morning or on the evening of June 25th, 2018, Mac was on his way down to Henderson for the weekly Monday night roast beef dinner at the Supper Club there in Henderson. On his way down, he was shot off his motorcycle by Blake Martin. Blake Martin was target shooting with his father, William Martin, and a cousin of William Martin by the name of Ian Stinson. Mac's injury was he was shot in the chest. The bullet went through the windshield of his motorcycle, landed in his, fortunately went through the windshield, landed in his chest. Fortunately, again, it was on the right side and not the left side, or he probably wouldn't be here today. How did this happen? Well, these three relatives, Stinson is from Tennessee and came up to Minnesota to visit his grandfather and his fiance's uncle, who was William Martin. And three of them, actually four of them, got together for target shooting. Three of them are defendants in this case. The fiance of Ian Stinson had virtually nothing to do with this target shooting incident, and she has not been named as a defendant in this case. They went to target shoot on
Mr. Grandy. I wanted, in the interest of time, I'd like to interrupt you and kind of fast forward to some of the legal issues because the court is I can assure you is very well familiar with the facts. Let me go straight to the issue of the joint enterprise doctrine that you have invoked. Am I right that on the second requirement of that doctrine, you need to prove that each member of the alleged enterprise had an equal say in the matters, an equal right to control each other?
Yes, Your Honor, that is the second requirement for a joint enterprise. In this case, if the court, backstop was the proximate cause because it played a substantial part in the injury to Mac, then the defendants all had control along control of the method of the assembling the backstop. As I was going to say earlier, and I'll say it now then, the father and son set up the lower part of the backstop. They rolled logs together. The son and the cousin wedged plywood on top of the logs, completing in part the backstop. The cousin put the green paper target on the plywood, the upper part of the backstop, the plywood. He placed it too high, established the wrong vertical line of fire. But he was the one who placed the target where he wanted to place the target. And he placed it in a way so that the only thing behind center mass and higher, where at least some of the defendants were shooting, was backed by only plywood. Then the father and the son with the cousin looking over their shoulder determined on Google Maps what they believed to be the right horizontal direction to set up the line of the target range so as not to potentially hit the County Road 40, which was below there, and that was wrong. They did that wrong because
let me follow up, Mr. Grandy. So are you saying that, going back to the issue of equal right to control, are you saying even though this occurred on the property of Blake Martin, and even though it was his materials that each of the three had an equal right to control the activities of the group?
In fact, each did control certain parts of the assembling of the backstop, which is approximate cause of Mac's injury.
I'd like to switch to the issue of the duty of care. It's an issue that respondents raised in their responsive briefs as an alternative grounds for affirming the district court. So to prevail, of course, have to establish a duty on behalf of the defendants. How would you describe that duty? I mean, is it a duty to ensure that no bullets ever leave the property? Is it something less than that? Is it a duty to ensure that if bullets leave the property, they do so in a safe direction, at a safe speed, at something else? I mean, how would you describe the obligation of three individuals who have set up a, say, somewhat makeshift temporary target practice range on private property for non-commercial purposes?
They have a duty of care in dealing with the public. They have a duty of care owed to Mac because of the and the presence of firearms and the exercise they were engaging in required extra care. And so they're setting up a target in the backstop, in particular, in a faulty, makeshift, defective way, made them responsible because the injury occurred because the bullets went through the target
Is that the foreseeability? Because the plywood was of a substance. I mean, clearly that could be penetrated? Is that why you're saying it was foreseeable that someone at quite a distance? I kind of struggle with that because it seems like quite a leap. I mean, this appears to be one of those, well, a strange occurrence.
I forgot what, so what is your question?
I'm asking what is the foreseeability?
The backstop was no more than a picture frame or a matting for a picture. It had no, and as counsel for the other side points out, they had no obligation to construct a hard barrier, for the target to be placed on. Now, they, in fact, when they place a porous backstop, put a target on it, and then shoot at that, they're responsible for wherever that bullet lands, because they all had firearms training. They all knew the importance of backstops. The reason that there are no reported target shooting cases involving a backstop is because the backstop is always impenetrable. It's a hard surface backstop. They had a backstop that wasn't even intended to be a hard surface from what counsel has argued. So yes, it's foreseeable if you put bullets, a firearm discharge in play without taking proper precautions, and the proper precautions would be lining up the range, preparing a backstop, and checking the direction that the gun is directed to ensure that it won't leave the property and hit someone. In this case, it went right onto the highway 40.
So your position is that the defendants had a duty to ensure that no bullets ever left the property?
Because of their construction, or because of their assembling, there is no construction that occurred in the backstop. All they did is roll some logs together. They found they had to choose between a mattress and a piece of plywood, and that was the job.
How do you show that is the proximate cause of the injury? You know, Judge Kane in this case said, you know, it was the gun that discharged that caused the injury. It wasn't the target.
Well, but Your Honor, erecting a haphazard backstop is a direct and proximate cause if the act was a substantial factor in the harm's occurrence. And it was a substantial factor. If there was an adequate backstop and the bullet had gone through the target and hit the backstop, there wouldn't have been an injury. And Judge Kane's example, I don't know what the law is on that, and I don't know what the responsibility is on that, but that's not what happened. The bullet went through a porous backstop and went through and ended up hitting Mac. It ended up hitting Mac because, in addition to having a porous backstop, they didn't set up the range adequately to avoid County Road 40. And as far as, gee, how far away was it? I mean, this was investigated extensively by the sheriff's office. I mean, those bullets have a range much farther than just the Highway 40. They have a range that is greater than Highway 40 by another 1,000 feet or so. So the idea that the road was far away, those guns are very powerful. We're not play. They weren't shooting BB guns or 22s. They were shooting the kinds of guns that, you know, have been made legendary by guys like, you know, make my day, Clint Eastwood with 40 calibers, or Schwarzenegger with his nine millimeter guns. I will return. You know, it's there. It was a 40 millimeter handgun that William had, and then the boys had two 9 millimeter guns. Those are, for lack of a better term, long range. They have a long range.
Not really.
Easily made the highway. So we sued for negligence.
Mr. Grandy, you have about a minute left of your initial allotment of 15 minutes of time.
Well, I might add that there's a case that if the backstop is proximate cause, there's liability for those, not just the shooter, but the participants in leading to the accident or injury. In that case, it was a drag racing case where not only was the drag racer who hit another car liable, but also the other participants drag racing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Grandy. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent William Martin, you may introduce yourself and your client and then begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Timothy Masterson. I represent William Martin, respondent in this case. Minnesota has long recognized that liability for the use of a firearm falls squarely on the individual who has the care, custody, and control of the firearm. We know from the cases cited in this case that claims based on theories of joint enterprise, as noted by the Supreme Court in Luer versus Johnson, that the holding in Delgado versus Lomar renders it virtually impossible for a joint enterprise to exist because the firearm is under the independent care, custody, and control of the owner. There are no facts in the record that even remotely suggest that Blake Martin was not exercising his own independent care, custody, and control of his gun on the day that the appellant was shot.
Well, I need to just refer you to on joint enterprise. So the common purpose is we're all going to go out and we're going to shoot at a target. I mean, you agree that there was at least an understanding that this is what we're getting together for?
They were getting together so that Ian Stinson can meet his cousins. Corollary to that,
I mean, they're bringing their guns. They have a target that's set up. I mean, obviously, they're engaging in a recreational pursuit. They have a common reason. At least my understanding is, I'm not speaking for my panel mates. So, if you are defeating the joint enterprise label, you would need to say that they each had their own voice in terms of how everything was constructed for that recreational purpose, wouldn't you?
Well, I agree that the parties were all in agreement as far as that they wanted to shoot while they were on the property. But
one question I do have, and I'm sorry, I should ask this sooner, because here's what I gleaned from the record. It looked as if on behalf of you're speaking on behalf of William Martin, that you initially contended that he did not help construct the target, that he didn't do anything. And yet I heard Mr. Grandy talk about, you know, putting everybody having a hand in it. So what's your version of that?
Sure. If you look at the testimony, the deposition testimony, when the parties were questioned specifically about what each party did and how they participated in setting up the target, it's clear that William Martin was not involved in that. he had gone in to visit with his grandchildren. He did provide the paper silhouette that was ultimately stapled to the plywood. But he was actually in with the grandchild while most of the setting up was taking place. Mr. Grandy refers to a plea hearing where there were some very vague and general statements made about setting up the target. And there's really no clarification as to what was being talked about at that time, other than there was a reference to the logs. And Mr. Martin had testified in his deposition that he had shot on Blake Martin's property before, and that they had maybe moved some stuff around before. So at some prior time, he had had some involvement with that. The question at the plea hearing referred to prior occasions as well as the day of, as far as what happened. And then again, William did admit that he provided the paper silhouette target that was hung on the plywood. So there was some level involvement. Mr. Martin, William, admitted that he had some involvement, but there was never anything specific discussed about what he actually did, what that actual involvement was.
But wouldn't that determination ultimately go to a jury versus a summary judgment decision?
If it was relevant, I suppose it might. The only allegation that has been made as far as what William Martin did do, and if you want to say there is some dispute as to what he did, it would center on the logs themselves. And that maybe he had done something involved with the placement of the logs. In the brief that appellant had filed opposing summary judgment in the district court, appellants argued their theory was that if the plywood with the target had been placed on the ground instead of on the logs, this case never would have happened. This accident never would have happened. So it was the placement, under that theory, it was the placement of the plywood that's the operative factor here, not the fact that there were some logs there and where those logs were configured. So that decision was not something that William Martin had any involvement in, and nobody has disputed that.
Are you aware of any case either in Minnesota or elsewhere where the accusation isn't solely the negligence on the part of a shooter, but on the part of a property owner for constructing some protection to prevent a bullet from leaving the property in a dangerous direction?
I am not aware of a case with that type of factual scenario.
I mean, doesn't that the allegation of a improperly constructed backstop at least significantly distinguish this case from Delgado, which is merely a hunting case involving no backstop?
I do not believe that to be the case because one, the backstop, the backstop is not the instrument that was part of the joint enterprise because that invokes a legal right to control, and there's no evidence there was any legal right to control the activities of one another. The only, and then this kind of goes back to your prior question, you know, the only special relationship or legal duty that I'm aware of that comes into play here is that of a property owner. And property owners have duties to warn other people of conditions that may be on their property.
Well, let's say I go into my neighbor's rural property and I construct a backstop and I invite my friends to shoot. And I indicate to them either expressly or implicitly that the backstop is safe. It will stop a bullet. And my friends then go to shooting and the bullet penetrates through a flimsy backstop, a piece of plywood, goes through, leaves the property and strikes someone else. You're suggesting that I would have no liability, only the property owner would have liability in that case?
I think in that
situation. And a shooter?
Yeah, and I think in that situation, you, by trespassing and building something on somebody else's property.
No, it's not a trespass. It was... The owner agreed to me being on the property and allowed me to construct the the object. Am I relieved of liability because it's not my property and I'm not the shooter?
I think there's a couple of scenarios at play here, Your Honor. One is property owner probably still has liability because now you have an agent of the property owner building that. I think the other situation you have is when somebody, the first person steps up and starts shooting and they see their bullets going through that piece of plywood, then everybody there is on notice that there's a bullet going through the plywood.
My question doesn't go to the shooter or the property owner. My question goes to me, the one who showed up and constructed the backstop. Are you suggesting that I'm relieved of liability because of it's not my property, the shooter, the property owner gave permission, and the shooter is individually liable, that I have no liability at all because there's no proximate cause?
There is a duty, a heightened duty, as we know, for somebody who is shooting their gun. And so the person who is shooting, if they know that the backstop's not stopping.
I'm not talking about the shooter. I'm sorry, your time has expired.
Please go ahead, Judge Ross.
So I'm not talking about the liability of the shooter or the property owner. I'm talking about the liability of the visitor who constructs a backstop, not a trespasser, and then indicates expressly or implicitly that the backstop is safe. You're suggesting no liability for that person.
I'm not aware of a case where that's ever been the factual scenario. I would say that you're describing a situation where other people relied solely on the person who built the backstop, who had no independent knowledge otherwise that it wasn't safe. And that somehow then they could place some responsibility on the person who built the shooting range based on some reliance. In this particular case, nobody was relying on William Martin to say that.
Yeah, but I still don't know your answer to my case, not this case. In my case, I just want to know, generally speaking, you seem to be suggesting there's never any liability for the person constructing the backstop. And I just wanted to see if that's really your position.
And my answer is I don't know because I haven't seen that case and I haven't looked at how the law would be.
As you understand the law of proximate cause, it's a simple scenario. I mean, how do you suppose that would apply? The law of proximate cause.
I don't see a special relationship here other than the fact that the person who's building it is an agent, so they're standing in the shoes of a property owner. So that's a possibility. There is, with that factual scenario, there may be other cases that are closer on point that might give us some more idea. That's not the facts in this case because William Martin didn't build a target range. He didn't tell everybody where things should be set up. This is a situation that was Blake Martin's property, and he was the one that was telling people where to find the stuff and where to set it up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Masterson.
Thank you.
Mr. Morley, you may introduce yourself and your client and present your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Matthew Morley. I represent the respondent, Ian Stinson, in this matter. Your Honors, it's very clear that this is a factually intensive case. I'd like to begin with just a quick administrative comment about an allegation in the reply brief of the appellant, specifically an admission that they claim was made by my client that is not in the record on appeal. At the top of page 4 of the reply brief, there's a quote attributed to my client about having been part of checking Google Maps and setting out the direction of shooting. The citation to that is not to any document in the record. It's to the memorandum of law of the appellant in the summary judgment motion, which in turn cites to a document in their affidavit for summary judgment that is incomplete. They specifically cite to page 9 of Exhibit 4 of their affidavit. That affidavit includes an exhibit four, which is made up of four complete pages of a document, a fifth partial page, and nothing after that. I don't have a copy of that document in my file, so I'm not in a position to stipulate that that comment was ever made. But since it's not in the record, it should not be considered here. What the record actually says about Ian Stinson's involvement in checking Google Maps was that he was not consulted whatsoever for his opinion on whether the direction of shooting was safe. Blake Martin is the one who pulled up Google Maps on his phone, and he had previously determined the direction of shooting and the location of shooting on the property here. All three of the deponents, who are fact witnesses to the events surrounding the shooting range, agreed to this. So Ian Stinson was not involved in determining the direction of shooting. I'd also like to point out there were comments made in appellant's initial argument here that Ian Stinson was involved in constructing the backstop. And I put it in my brief, and I think it's clear that no party testified that Ian Stinson erected the plywood backstop. William Martin did say something about him remembering seeing Ian and his fiance rifle through the wood pile, but he specifically said, no, I did not see them put up the plywood and position it with all of the others.
Mr. Morley, wouldn't, again, this is a summary judgment determination. Wouldn't this then be a question of fact that would have to go to a jury? I mean, you're saying no, and the other side is saying yes, and it sounds as if there's a muddle of indecision on who did what.
Judge, I simply don't agree that misciting the record creates a question of fact. There is no question of fact if there's no testimony.
What I'm getting at, Mr. Morley, you didn't motion the court to strike anything in the responding brief, and I'd like to get to the heart of the argument in the time that you have, because it is limited. My point is exactly what you're saying leads me to believe that there is a question as to who did what, and how do you make this decision at the summary judgment stage?
Well, the decision would be made very briefly by saying that there is no question of fact, because there's no testimony supporting the argument.
Somebody had to build the target. That's my point. So if in fact that is, if we decide that that could have been a contributing proximate cause of the injury, doesn't that question of who did what need to be decided by the fact finder?
No, Your Honor. And I'll tell you what the facts say in the deposition testimony. The facts say, according to Ian Stinson's testimony, the piece of plywood had already been erected before he got to the wood pile to staple the paper target to it. So at that point in time, Blake Martin had already set up both the location where they were going to shoot from and the piece of plywood that they were going to shoot at. Ian Stinson helped staple the piece of paper to the plywood. And if you look at the photographs in the record, he really didn't have a choice of where it went. The piece of paper was basically the same width as the piece of plywood. If he would have, there was nowhere to put it any higher, and there was nowhere to put it any lower, because any lower it would have been in amongst the logs and sticks that were holding up the plywood. So he made no determination as to the layout of this range. His only involvement was helping to staple this piece of paper up, which very clearly is not meant to stop a bullet. It didn't change any of the circumstances of Blake Martin firing his gun in that direction he did at the piece of plywood he did. Clearly a piece of paper isn't going to stop it. So it's not a proximate cause. It's not a direct cause, because the piece of paper was irrelevant to the injury eventually suffered. So that's how it's decided on summary judgment, is that there's undisputed facts, and it leads to the conclusion that there is no proximate or direct cause.
Now, if the target were stapled lower, I mean, it's true, the plywood, looking at the photograph, the plywood seems to, well, you could have stapled the top of the target, I assume, in a lower position so that the center mass of the target would have been stopped, would have been buttressed by the logs behind it. Would you agree that that's a plausible means of affixing the target? You seem to be suggesting that the only way you can staple the target to the to the backstop is the is to have it up high enough that it, the top of the target is near the top of the part of the plywood. It doesn't seem to, I don't know if that's logical though, if that's necessarily so.
I don't know if it's logical. I was hoping to comment on this too, on the joint enterprise issue, that the only person here who truly had a purpose for doing this other than purely recreating was Blake Martin, because he was there to practice for his police exam. So I don't know if it makes any sense. When it wasn't Ian Stinson's choice to use a paper target, it was handed to him and he was to put it up on the plywood. I don't know that it makes any sense for someone shooting at a paper target for it to be so low to the ground that it either doesn't resemble a normal situation you'd see in a police exam, or it resembles very darkly a child or small person. So I don't think anybody would think to walk up to a piece of plywood already erected that, oh, I should put this down low to the ground, even though it mimics the person and it's for somebody taking a police exam to practice for. I see that my time's almost up. If nobody has any other questions, I'll say thank you, and we respectfully request affirmance of the summary judgment dismissal.
I have a question. I'd like to give you a chance to, I guess, to respond to the reply brief. So in your, to be clear, in your respondent's brief, you raised the issue of duty as an alternative ground for affirmance in the reply brief. And I think if I remember correctly, your argument is that had to do with the fact that no one has a duty to protect a plaintiff, protect a person from harm by a third party. But plaintiff invoked case law about, on page 11, I'm looking right now, the duty to prevent foreseeable harm when the defendant's conduct creates a dangerous situation, an appellant cited Domagala. Do you have any, you didn't have a chance to file a brief after that reply brief. I'm wondering if you wish to give any oral response to that argument by appellant in the reply brief.
I do, and thank you for letting me do that. And I should have, in retrospect, done it in the response brief, but I think the better analysis is to look at the Fenrick versus the Blake School case, the 2018 Minnesota Supreme Court case, which relies on Domagala. And it's more explicit in laying out that there's two exceptions to the general rule that a duty of care is not owed for a third party's conduct. One of the exceptions is what's been discussed at length here in our briefing, which is a special relationship. And I don't think it warrants any time because there simply is no special relationship here as identified in prior case law. The other exception is when the defendant's own conduct creates a foreseeable risk to a foreseeable plaintiff. And that analysis gets further narrowed down to saying that the quote unquote own conduct can only create a duty if it's active misfeasance as opposed to passive nonfeasance. And you only get to the question of foreseeability if there is active misfeasance. The misfeasance here, without question, is Blake Martin shooting at a target that eventually allowed a bullet onto a public highway. Everything else, and for the reasons that I discussed earlier, Ian Stinson's minimal decision-making in the actual layout of this shooting range, everything else could only be characterized as nonfeasance, especially Ian Stinson's actions.
I appreciate your raising the Fenrick case. In that case, the most direct tortfeasor was the teenage student who drove the vehicle negligently and caused an accident. Yep. But the school was held liable because of the actions of school staff who were coordinating, traveling, and so on. So, and that was deemed by the Supreme Court to be misfeasance. I mean, you have to agree that Fenrich does not foreclose the possibility that even though Blake fired that shot, other persons could have engaged in misfeasance.
It doesn't foreclose that possibility, but this case is the opposite, because in Fenrich, the school and the staff in particular, the court found took an active role in planning and preparing for the trip to the cross-country meet. They coordinated the entire trip. And here, looking specifically at my client, Ian Stinson, he's a guy who's never been to this property. This is his first trip to Minnesota. He just met his step cousin who owns this property. He shows up, a shooting range location and direction has already been established. He's not consulted for his opinion on whether the shooting range is safe. And he's only asked to help by putting up a paper target on an already constructed log and plywood backstop. So he doesn't take any sort of active role, anything that could be considered misfeasance, as was considered misfeasance in the Blake School case on behalf of the school staff.
Appreciate that. I have one more question following up on Fenrich, and that is another issue that goes to the question of duty is foreseeability. Since you're familiar with the facts of Fenrich, which do you think is more or less foreseeable? A licensed teenage driver getting into a fatal car accident on a particular day, or bullets leaving a non-commercial firing range and striking a passenger who's driving a motorcycle on a nearby street?
Well, Your Honor, they're both definitely within the realm of possibility, which Fenrich says is not the test. And we have to look at this objectively from a reasonable person in the shoes of my client. And I think in that case, it's more likely that a teenager driving a 5.5-hour car ride is going to get an accident without adult supervision than somebody in my client's shoes, who, like I said, is completely unfamiliar with this property in the area and has shown up and has been assured multiple times. And not only was he assured, but his aunt was assured when she inquired about the safety of the direction of shooting in particular. Somebody in his shoes looking at a shooting range that's told to be safe and seeing nothing but dense woods behind, I don't think it's foreseeable for this to have happened to somebody objectively in his shoes.
Thank you, Mr. Morley. If there are no further questions from the panel for you, then I will call upon Mr. Grandy. You may present your rebuttal argument. And if I could ask you, Mr. Grandy, to begin with the question of the evidence of Mr. Stinson's involvement in setting up the firing range and setting up the materials. There seems to be Mr. Morley disputes the existence of evidence of his conduct, I believe. Could you address that to begin with?
Yes, Your Honor. And I can't point to it because I didn't write the brief, but we asserted in the brief that Ian and his cousin, Blake, the two of them set the plywood either set it on top of the logs or adjusted it on the logs, and then Ian placed the target there. That's the only thing I can say. I mean, I can try to BS you, but I'm not going to do that. So what I could say about Ian,
I'm assuming you agree if the citation in your brief doesn't take us to actual evidence that was submitted to the district court for summary judgment purposes as to anyone viewing, in particular, viewing the Google map and determining the location of the target, that's not, despite the references, we wouldn't consider that for the purpose of summary judgment.
That would seem to be logical, Your Honor. There's about 900 pages of investigation, and Ian was in this, not up to his eyeballs like Blake and his father William were, but I'd say this about Ian: it was his first time in Minnesota. They did contemplate target shooting on the way up. This was not something that they talked about the day of the event. He brought his gun from Tennessee. Who carries their unloaded gun when you travel Not very many people. So this was contemplated, target shooting. He had gun safety training. He saw what the target looked like. He saw that above 2 or 3 feet up, above the few logs on the bottom, there was nothing. It was like a frame for a target to be shot through. So he has observed the assembly, and somebody in his shoes who sees a target that is not a barrier, is not a way of protecting people behind, when he sees that and he still shoots, or he allows his cousin to shoot, he's breaching a duty that he owes to people, because he knows from his gun training that, I mean, these are very serious, powerful bullets, and they can go, he didn't think they'd go out onto the county road, because he didn't think the county road was there, but they did.
Well, somebody in his shoes. I'd like to speak to the foreseeability then, with the lay of the land. There's not just the backstop issue, but it's a wooded area.
Yeah, but they didn't go down. Okay, I think it's a question of fact. How much investigation they did? They did not walk down area. It's a slope going down. They shot downhill, and at the bottom of the gully was the County Road 40. If you walk down there, you would see that you got problems. It is not a solid barrier. The woods are not a solid barrier to County Road 40. So it's foreseeable. I mean, should have been foreseeable. He was negligent for not investigating. And did he owe a duty? Yeah, when he constructed, or when he allowed to be constructed, that defective, haphazard barrier, he's liable for the results. He's liable for the consequences. They shouldn't have been shooting at where there's no real barrier, no real backstop. So the other thing is, Delgado is distinguishable from this case. Target shooting is not like game hunting. Wild game hunting, hunters have different lines of fire, different lines of sight. They can't control the animal, the target, and then they have to make split-second decisions. I can understand, and everybody can understand.
Well, I don't know that's your strongest point of distinction from Delgado. I think, if there's a distinction, it seems to me that you're focused on the backstop, and if there's a joint enterprise in constructing the backstop, that seems to be the only basis to distinguish Delgado. Otherwise, you've got individual shooters, and then Delgado, it was actually the lawyer John Simonette who was arguing that there should be a joint enterprise in the Supreme Court before, of course, he became a member of the court, disagreed with him, but the point he was trying to make was that they were all joined together in the hunting enterprise, and the Supreme Court said, no, that's not a joint enterprise. They're all individually shooters. They all had, you may have been, even if they had been shooting at the same bird, it would have been not a joint enterprise under the reasoning of Delgado. So I'm not sure that case, I think the distinguish that case is not based upon the fact that they were joining in target practice. I think it's the backstop argument is your only way of getting that. That's just my own opinion.
Well, Your Honor, you've had plenty of experience with guns, so I'll respect your wisdom and your experience. Your wisdom based on your experience. Thank you, Your Honor. Nothing further then.
Thank you, Mr. Grandy, for your rebuttal argument. Thanks to all the attorneys.